The elders which are among you, I exhort, who am also an elder, and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. Feed the flock of God which is among you, taking the oversight thereof, not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind. Neither as being lords over God's heritage, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd shall appear, ye shall receive a crown of glory that fadeth not away. And may God bless the reading of his word. This morning we've come to the final chapter of 1 Timothy. That doesn't mean we're about to finish our study. What it does mean is that Timothy's starting to wrap things up with some final thoughts and some final exhortations. The first... Did I say Timothy?
Yeah.
Peter. See, if you pay attention from up here, you see things. And something just wasn't right. I wasn't sure what it was. We've come to the final chapter of 1 Peter. And Peter is giving us some final exhortations. The first final exhortation, and there are several, the first one is in verses 1 to 4. It has to do with the leadership in the church. We'll not actually get to the exhortation today. We're going to look at the background of that exhortation. There are three things here that I think are significant. There's the reason for the exhortation, there's the nature of his exhortation, and there's the giver of the exhortation. So those things in mind, let's start with the first thing. We've got the reason for the exhortation. Now, how many of you have a translation in front of you where the first word of the text is either the word therefore or the word so? How many of you have that translation? How many of you have a translation with neither of those words there? King James does not include either of those words, and so it leads to the question, why not? Well, the reason is because some of the texts, the Greek text, include the word wherefore, and some of them don't include, so there's a variation in the Greek text. So depending on which Greek text the translator was using, they either translated it if it was there or didn't translate it if it were not there. One of the challenges when you're studying the New Testament is that we don't have the original text. What we would give to have the actual parchment or whatever Peter wrote on in his hand with the original in our hands, but we don't have any of that. What we have are copies of the text. And this has led critics to say that you really can't trust the New Testament because all you have is copies and there are discrepancies between those texts. And I can't argue with that. There are some discrepancies between the various copies that we have. But what's interesting to me is how insignificant those discrepancies are. I mean, the fact that Peter either started this sentence with the word therefore or he didn't, no issue of faith or practice for me rests upon that disputed text. This is not a theologically significant difference here. And there really aren't that many discrepancies. My Greek teacher used to say that if we took all the discrepancies between the various copies we have of the New Testament and put them on a page, it would be about a half a page of the Greek New Testament. And most of them are about as significant as what we're looking at this morning. Whether or not Peter used the word therefore. Now, I've known some Greek students who could spend the next 30 minutes doing their best to convince you one way or the other and why they think it's significant or not. I'll spare you of all of that this morning. I'll simply say this, that whether or not Peter actually used the word therefore, the reason for his exhortation is the same. The church was about to go through some very difficult times. And it was very important during that time that the church leadership step up to the plate and lead the church. Now, the word therefore would have made the connection very, very clear so that we would have known precisely that this is the connection that Peter is making. Nonetheless, the connection is there. And all you got to do is read the previous chapter, and it puts things in context. For instance, if you drop that chapter 4 and look at verse 12. He says, "Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you." Tough times are coming. This is not just going to be your run-of-the-mill trial. This is going to be a fiery trial that you're going to go through. And then look at the last verse, verse 19. "Wherefore, let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him and well-doing as unto a faithful creator. The elders which are among you I exhort." Now, just reading that with that flow, you would naturally assume the reason he's exhorting the elders is because of this difficult time that's coming. So with or without the word therefore, Peter sees that very difficult times are coming for the church, and he wants the church leadership to be standing in place when it happens. Now, his exhortation for the leadership can be summarized in three words. The role of the leadership in the church is to feed the flock, to lead the flock, and to protect the flock. We're not going to get to that today, but that's really essentially what Peter is going to say to those who are in leadership positions in the church. The first thing I want you to see, though, about this exhortation is that it was appropriate to the time. This is just the word the church needed at that time. There was a reason for this exhortation. The reason was that hard times are coming, and if the church ever needs its leadership to be in place, guiding them by their example and encouraging them and protecting them and helping them, it's certainly during times of trouble and difficulty. God's message was appropriate to the time. And you know, I'm gonna spiritualize just a moment, if you'll allow me that privilege of doing that. I don't do this often, but I'm going to. It just seems to me that in life, sometimes God gives us a therefore and sometimes he doesn't. Have you experienced that? I mean, there are times we go through experiences and we think, why is God letting this happen to me? There are some times when we stand back and we can say, well, I can understand why God would do this. There are some times we look at God's commands and we think, why is God telling me this? There are other times when we look at his commands and it's very clear to us why God is telling us this. Doesn't matter either way, God has a plan. God has it under control. God has a reason. I really appreciate the song that Susanna just sang, and I like the chorus a lot. I'm going to say the words to the chorus again, just so it rings in your head. God is too wise to be mistaken. God is too good to be unkind. So when you don't understand, when you don't see his plan, when you can't trace his hand, trust his heart. God always has a reason. God had a reason for this exhortation for the leadership of the church that Peter was writing to. So back to the text. The reality is that the leadership should always lead, feed, and protect the flock. I mean, when is there a time in the history of the church a pastor shouldn't be feeding the flock? I mean, that's my primary task, isn't it? You come here and I open God's word and give you what God has to say to us today. That's always our job. But boy, that job is especially important when people are suffering for their faith. Peter's message here is really kind of prescient. I mean, he sees difficulties coming. He reminds me of a group of people in the Old Testament. This comes from 1 Chronicles chapter 12. The story is that King David was finally ascending the throne of Israel. He had been a fugitive from Saul for many years. And then when Saul died, he became king in the lower part of the kingdom over the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. And now the kingdom, the entire kingdom of Israel, is coming over to him. And various groups from Israel are coming to welcome him. One of the groups was the tribe of Issachar. And here's what the text says about the children of Issachar. The children of Issachar, which were men that had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do. They were men who had understanding of the times and knew what Israel ought to do. I think Peter was a man who had understanding of the times. He looked around him and he saw the things that were happening and he realized that the church was in danger of serious persecution. I don't think that he needed special revelation to see that happening. Now, he might have had that. God might have given him some prophetic word that things are going to get really bad. But folks, you don't have to be a prophet to see when things are getting bad and when the clouds are gathering. That's why for the last several months, I've been warning you, the clouds are gathering. We as a church need to prepare because the time will come when you and I are made to stand for our faith or back down from our faith. It's just in the cards. It's just happening. And I'm not a prophet, and I don't know any more than anybody else. I just know what I see. Just this week, I was reading the latest issue of World Magazine. Here are two stories I pulled out of World Magazine just on Friday as I was eating my breakfast. This comes from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Paul Church, who has served on the medical staff as urologist for 28 years, recently suggested that hospital no longer support and sponsor Boston's Gay Pride Parade. And he gave two reasons for that. One was because there are people on the staff who don't agree with it, and it's an insult and an offense to them. Two is because homosexual behaviors lead to higher risk of serious diseases. Now, folks, this is not hate speech. This is not making any, that's just fact. homosexual behavior leads to higher risk of diseases, serious diseases like HIV, AIDS, like anal cancer. Men especially who engage in that behavior are exposing themselves to risks that other men do not have. Here's what he said. It's like a baby food company sponsoring an abortion clinic, or like a cigarette advertisement in a medical journal. It just makes no sense. They fired him for that. 28 years. Fired. He appealed. In December, his last appeal ran out. His job is done. Because he took a stand, first off, for logical sense, and secondly, for biblical morality that cost him his job. Here's another story from the city of New York. The city's Commission on Human Rights in December issued rules that impose fines up to $250,000 on employers or landlords. So if you have employees or you have tenants, if you lived in New York, listen to this. You could pay up to $250,000 fine for, here's the crime, misgendering employees or tenants. Any of you ever heard that word? Misgender? Here's what the rule says. You must use an individual's preferred name, pronoun, and title, regardless of the individual's sex assigned at birth, anatomy, gender, medical history, appearance, or the sex indicated on the individual's identification. So if the driver's license says they're a male, but they identify as a female, you'd better refer to them as she and not he. It's going to cost you $250,000. That's New York values, by the way. Oh, I just got political. I don't mean to do that. See, I read stories like that, and I think Bible-believing Christians are in for it. The cards are stacked against us. You don't have to be a prophet. You don't have to be prescient. You just keep your eyes open, and you say, this is the direction things are going. That's what Peter did. He just had his eyes open, he saw difficult times coming, and he responded with a timely exhortation for God's people. So that's the timing or whatever I said about the, what did I say about that exhortation, see? That's the reason for his exhortation. Let's look next at the nature of his exhortation. The nature of the exhortation is found in that word exhort. He says, the elders which are among you, I exhort. That's an interesting word in the Greek. It's a combination of two Greek words, para, which means alongside, and kaleo, which kind of means like it sounds, to call someone alongside. When you call someone alongside of you, maybe it's to encourage them, maybe it's to comfort them, maybe it's to beseech them. But what I want you to see here is that Peter was not making demands on his readers. He was exhorting them. Maybe it'd be helpful to see a couple of places where that word is used elsewhere in the New Testament. You don't have to turn here. I'll just tell you about them. In Mark chapter 5, Jesus was passing through Gadara, and a man came out to meet him who was possessed of a devil. You'll remember this man. He's the one who lived among the tombs. They tried to bind him, but he'd break his binds, and he would beat people up as they came through. He was a real menace, and nobody could do anything about it. So this man came out to meet Jesus. Jesus expelled the demon from him and healed him. And I love the text because it said the man was sitting at Jesus' feet in his right mind. And you know, you're never really in your right mind until you come to know Jesus as your Savior and you're sitting at his feet. That's where you're really in your right mind. But at the end of the story, as Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. The word begged is parakaleo. He didn't demand. He didn't say, I'm going with you, Jesus, like it or not. It was, Jesus, could I go with you? May I please go with you? That's the sense of what Peter is saying. The elders which are among you, I beg of you. I'm asking you. It's not, I'm demanding you, you must do this. It's not the meaning of this word, parakaleo. Another use of the word is in Acts chapter 8. You'll remember this story. Philip the evangelist is walking through the desert alongside the chariot. In the chariot is an Ethiopian eunuch. And the Ethiopian is reading a scroll of Isaiah, apparently reading it out loud. And Philip's running alongside the chariot. And he looks up at this is just a funny picture to me. I mean, the chariot's moving down the road, and this stranger's running alongside, listening to this guy read Isaiah. And I expect he was huffing and puffing. He says, hey, do you understand what you read? And the man said to him, how can I understand unless somebody explains it to me? And the text says he invited Philip to come up and sit with him. The word translated invited, that's our word parakaleo. See, that's not a demand. That isn't requiring. That's saying, would you come up and talk with me about this? There's a difference between demanding and exhorting. Peter did not demand, he exhorted. Somebody has said that there are two kinds of leadership in the workplace. Maybe you've noticed this where you work. There is demand leadership and there is command leadership. Demand leadership says, do what I say because I'm in charge here. Any of you have a boss like that? I'm boss, you do what I say. Command leadership says, follow my example. Demand leadership says, respect me. Command leadership deserves, it commands respect because of the way you treat your employees. The Apostle Paul gave us an example of the difference between those two concepts in a little letter he wrote called Philemon. The story of Philemon is this. Philemon was a wealthy landowner in Colossae. He had slaves. And one of his slaves, a guy named Onesimus, ran away. Well, he made his way to Rome. It just happened that Paul was in prison in Rome. And somehow Onesimus and Paul got together. And Paul led Onesimus to Jesus Christ. Well, now he's a new man. And under the laws of the time, he needs to go back to his master Philemon. Problem with that scenario is the law he broke was punishable by death. At the very least, by a flogging, but it could well cost him his life to go back to his master Philemon. But here's the rest of the story. Paul, several years before, had led Philemon to Christ and had a relationship with him. So he wrote Philemon a letter on behalf of this runaway slave, and we have it in our New Testament. We know it is Philemon. It's a wonderful little story. And in the letter, listen to what Paul said to Philemon. He says, wherefore, though I might be much bold in Christ to enjoin thee, to demand of you, to make requirements of you of what is fitting. See, I led you to Christ. I'm an apostle. I could just say, Philemon, take this man back. Yet, for love's sake, I'm not going to make demands. For love's sake, I rather beseech you. There's our word parakaleo. I'm asking you. Being such an one as Paul the aged, and now also a prisoner of Jesus Christ, I beseech thee for my son Onesimus, whom I've gotten in my bonds. There's a difference between demanding and asking. In our text, Peter is not making demands. He's exhorting. Would you do this, please? I beg of you. I invite you to do this. That's the approach in the text. You know, there's a time and a place for making demands. Emergencies and deadlines are good examples of that. But the wise leader knows the difference, and Peter, I think, knew the difference. He's pleading with the church leadership to do what's right. So we've seen the reason for his exhortation. We've seen the nature of the exhortation. Now let's look at the giver of the exhortation. Obviously, the one giving the exhortation is who? Peter. Okay, that's simple enough. Let me tell you some things about Peter. Peter, first off, was an apostle of Jesus Christ. That means he was hand-selected by Jesus Christ himself to speak on his behalf. That is a position that went away with the apostles. There are no apostles today. And I don't care what radio preachers say. I mean, you'll hear radio preachers say, I'm apostle so-and-so. Okay. That's not like New Testament apostleship. This was a position in the church of highest authority. That's who Peter was. Peter was one of the inner circle. Now, when you think about Jesus and his followers, I think all of us think, well, he had 12 disciples. Well, yeah, he did, but he had a lot more followers than that. I mean, Luke chapter 7 talks about these women who followed him around and donated to his ministry. I think there were probably several hundred who would convene with Christ at any given time. He had a crowd of followers, and within that large group of followers, there were the 12. And those are the ones that we always think about when we think about the disciples. Within the 12, there was an inner circle of the three, and the three included Peter, James, and John. They had special privileges that none of the other of the 12 had. And then within that smaller group, there was John, the one that Jesus loved, and they appear to have had a very special relationship. But Peter is one of the three. He saw and did things that none of the others did. For instance, when the daughter of Jairus died, Jesus put everybody out of the room except Peter, James, and John. What happened to the other disciples, the other nine? Well, I guess they stood outside on the sidewalk. Peter, James, and John got to go inside and watch the action. Boy, that was exciting action because Jesus raises his little girl from the dead. Peter was a very privileged man. Peter was one of those who were invited by Jesus on the night of his betrayal to be in the Garden of Gethsemane with him as he prayed. Peter was one of the inner circle. Peter was first among the 12 disciples. The reason I say that is because anytime you read a list of their names, guess who's named first? Peter. Oh, by the way, guess who's named last? Judas Iscariot. Well, that's fitting. Peter's always named first. Peter was the one who made the great confession. You remember that day Jesus said to his disciples, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" Peter answered and said, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus turned to him and said, "Blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonas. Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father, which is in heaven." That's a pretty special blessing, isn't it? And then it's in that same conversation that Jesus gave to Peter the keys to the kingdom. He didn't give them to anybody else. Peter's a special man. Peter is one of those to whom Jesus said that when the Son of Man shall sit in the throne of his glory, you also, and in this case he's talking to all 12 of his disciples, he says, when I come back in my glory, you'll be sitting on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Someday, Peter will don his magisterial robes and he will sit on the throne and judge the nation of Israel. This is not just some low-level disciple we're looking at here. This is Peter. Given those qualifications, don't you think Peter might have had the right to just tell those elders what to do? I mean, couldn't he have assumed his apostolic authority and just pushed them around? Well, maybe. But Peter had a humbler opinion of himself than that. Let's look at three ways he describes himself in verse 1. First off, the elders which are among you I exhort. Notice this next phrase. Who am also an elder? I'm just one of you. By the way, Peter's starting to get old by this time. We're talking the year 60 AD. The events of Christ happened 30 years before. I don't know how old Peter was when Jesus called him. Maybe 20, maybe 30. So he's in his 50s, 60s, maybe older at this point. He's lived quite a lengthy life of following Jesus Christ, and I think he's begun to mellow. He's no longer that hothead who wants to push everybody around. It's just, hey, I'm asking you as a fellow elder. I'm just one of you. Second thing he says, I'm also a witness of the sufferings of Christ. Now, the word witness means more than just a spectator. It's one who testifies about what they've seen. Peter had seen the sufferings of Christ, and he also testified about those sufferings. How many of you know that song, "Were You There When They Crucify My Lord"? Anybody like me ever think that's kind of a weird song? Were you there when they crucified my Lord? No, I wasn't there. I wasn't even born yet. I mean, had that ever occurred to anybody else when you sing that song? Now, theologically, yeah, I was there. I was crucified with Christ. I get all of that. I died on the cross with him. I mean, but physically, I wasn't even around. Peter was there. Peter was there. You know, it's interesting that after Luke tells about Peter's denial of Christ, remember the little girl asking, "Hey, you were with Jesus?" "Oh, I wasn't." And then he cursed and swore and stomped off, and the rooster crowed, and he realized he had denied Christ. And it's interesting that Luke is the one who mentions that Christ looked at him. And when Christ looked at Peter, Peter went out and wept bitterly. I think I would have done the same. How about you? But in this text we're looking at, he says he was a witness of the sufferings of Christ. I wonder if he circled back and stood off in the distance and watched his Lord on that cross as a witness of the sufferings of Christ. I saw his sufferings. Third thing he says about himself, I was also a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. A partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. Hold on. If it shall be revealed, then it's not yet been revealed, right? I mean, follow the logic here. So if it's not yet been revealed, how was I a partaker of that which has not yet been revealed? Well, I think the answer is in Matthew chapter 16. Jesus on this occasion told his disciples, there be some standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Some of you, he's talking to his 12 disciples, some of you are going to see the Son of Man in his kingdom. You're not going to die before it happens. And then the next chapter says about 6 days later, Jesus took Peter, James, and John. There's that inner circle again. On a high mountain. And he was transfigured before them. See, what I think happened on that occasion is when Jesus came to earth, he laid aside his divine glory. And on this occasion, he resumed his divine glory. And the disciples looked up, and guess who's standing there talking with Jesus? Moses and Elijah. And Jesus is brilliant. I mean, they can hardly look at him because of this brilliance that's emanating from him. He got a glimpse of the glory of Christ. I shared with the glory that shall be revealed. Someday everybody's going to see that glory. I just got a nice glimpse of it. Peter had some tremendous privileges, hadn't he? I was in the inner circle. I saw the sufferings of Christ. I got a glimpse of his glory. And in spite of all of that, I'm really just one of you. I'm an elder just like you. About a year and a half ago, I had the privilege of taking my family to Rome, Italy. It's a place I've wanted to visit for years, simply because of the church history in that place. And on the Sunday, we, if you can call it this, we went to church at the Vatican and listened to Pope Francis give the message. I don't know what language he spoke. I didn't understand it. I presume it was Italian. But the Vatican is just a fabulous place. I mean, in terms of architecture and beauty and wealth, it's awe-inspiring in that sense. So we're standing in this open plaza, and I'm guessing there are probably 7,000 or 8,000 people there that day. And you look up in this high window over here. There's this little window, I don't know, 4 or 5 stories high, and there's a banner hanging below the windowsill. And when the Pope appears, he appears in that little window. And he's just a little speck. I mean, he's that far away, and he gives his message. Well, the Catholic Church has this theory that that man, the Pope, is the vicar of Christ. The word vicar means substitute. What they mean by that is he's Christ to us. He's the replacement or substitute of Christ on the earth. And that he holds the position of Pope, and that Peter was the first vicar of Christ. Because when Christ left, Peter assumed the responsibility of representing him, and that the popes can actually trace their authority right back to him. And the pomp and the opulence that surrounds in that place is just staggering. But he's really held up as being almost more than a man. He's the vicar of Christ. You know, it's interesting to contrast what I saw at the Vatican that day with what I see in this text. Peter didn't have on some fancy robe. He didn't have that mitre on his head. He didn't wear those satin red shoes. He didn't have any ring on his finger for anybody to bow down and kiss. He just says, listen, guys, I'm exhorting you. I'm asking you. Elders, I'm one of you. I look back and I wonder if Peter were just suddenly dropped in that plaza where I was at the Vatican and allowed to look around and see what they've done with his tradition. What would he think? I don't think he'd recognize it. I think he would be stunned, and I don't think that would be a positive thing. I think he'd step back and say, hold on, time out, none of this pomp. I'm no better than you. I'm just like one of you. Here we see the humility of this man. The reality is that Peter saw and did things that you and I will never see or do, but he kept a level head. He remained humble. Makes me think of those words from Micah chapter 6, verse 8. He has showed thee, O man, what is good and what doth the Lord require of thee, but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. I don't think Peter always walked humbly with God. I think when Christ first called him, he was a very proud man who was out to impress others. I also think by the time he wrote this little letter, he had been transformed. He was a man who had learned to walk humbly before his God and put everything in that perspective. And in that sense, I think Peter is an example for you and I. The message this morning is just what Micah said. Walk humbly with thy God. Certainly none of us are any better than Peter. So none of us have the right to be proud. We all have the right to walk humbly Not throwing our weight around, not trying to make other people do what we think they ought to do, but as humble servants of Jesus Christ, ministering to others. And Father, I thank you for these truths. I pray that like Peter, we would walk humbly before you, that we not be caught up in pride and thinking we're such hot stuff. Father, like Peter, may we just take our place humbly and serve you with all our hearts. For Jesus' sake and in his name, amen.